In this hour of midday, we travel back 100 years to 1914, when the president was Woodrow Wilson, a progressive with a law degree from the University of Virginia, who had received a PhD from the Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, who had served as president of Princeton and as a governor of New Jersey. 1914 was the middle of Wilson's first term. It was also the year Europe erupted in all-out war, and it was Wilson who managed to keep the United States from entering that war, at least for a time. Therein lays a tale, how an American president, who envisioned himself a peacemaker, fell to pieces under a burden too great to bear. Washington College historian Richard Striner tells the story on Midday, after the news. Welcome to Midday. I'm Dan Rodericks. Thanks for joining us. To begin this hour of conversation with historian Richard Striner, I'm going to mark off some time on the American grandfather clock, and I'll do it in clean segments, in centuries and half centuries. 2014 marks 200 years since the British attack on the Port of Baltimore and the bombardment of Fort McHenry. Bicentennial events this year celebrate the successful defense of Baltimore by the American forces that repulsed British sea and land invasions in 1814. 2014 marks 150 years since President Abraham Lincoln made General Ulysses Grant Commander-in-Chief of the Union Army in the Civil War. And 1864 was also the year of President Lincoln's re-election. 100 years ago, things were generally quiet on the American home front, but the threat of war loomed in Europe. The president of the United States was Woodrow Wilson, who had been born in Virginia just before the Civil War, and who once told of having been in the presence of Robert E. Lee and having looked up at the Confederate general's face. Wilson was a progressive Democrat who had been elected in 1912. After 2 good years in the White House, Wilson faced large questions about America's role in preventing the outbreak of a world war. And once it started in the summer of 1914, brokering a peace among the belligerents. Therein lies a great tale and, as you'll hear, a tragedy within a tragedy. Our guest this hour is by now familiar to Midday listeners, for Richard Striner has contributed mightily to our understanding of American history, and particularly presidential history. He has provided commentary on Midday Fridays that lends historical perspective to contemporary events. And there's promise for that in this hour as we hear about President Wilson and the debate about whether the United States should or should not intervene in a foreign conflict. Richard Striner is a professor of history at Washington College in Chestertown. He is a Lincoln scholar whose books include Father Abraham, Lincoln's Relentless Struggle to End Slavery, and Lincoln's Way, How Six Great Presidents Created American Power. His latest work is Woodrow Wilson and World War I, A Burden Too Great to Bear. Richard Striner, welcome back to Midday. It's nice to have you back with us.
Oh, it's great to be here, Dan.
Woodrow Wilson, 1914, a world about to step into a war. I wish you'd describe that world for us before we get to President Wilson, the subject of your book. 1914, in the United States and in Europe, what was happening?
Well, in the United States, an exciting election had just occurred in 1912, the election that propelled Woodrow Wilson into the White House. It was an era that many at the time called the Progressive Era. Historians would continue to call it that, but it was known that way at the time because for about a generation in the Gilded Age, accumulating problems, accumulating internal divisions and antagonisms, some of them regional, some of them class-based, a lot of them, though by no means all of them, economic in their fundamentals. Add to this, too, major economic depressions in the 1870s and 1890s, great upsurge of grassroots insurgent protest, formation in the 1890s of a short-lived but important political party, the Populist Party, led by the end of the 19th century in the 1890s to a widespread feeling that things were really coming apart for the United States, that the United States might already have joined the dismal roster of civilizations that rose and fell, that America's best days might already be behind it.
Did the progressive era hold promise?
Well, the progressive era was to a large extent a response to these concerns. It was the work of leaders like Theodore Roosevelt, who insisted that America's days were not already behind her, but that vigorous, intelligent responses to America's problems had to be developed.
So what came out of the progressive era?
Well, a lot of things came out of the progressive era, not least of all new forms of federal regulation under Theodore Roosevelt and in the early presidency of Woodrow Wilson. The regulation of food and drugs under Theodore Roosevelt greatly enhanced federal efforts in natural resource conservation. Long-term planning for public works, hydroelectric utilities, a lot of things like that done during the Roosevelt years and during Wilson's first 2 years, the creation of the Federal Trade Commission, creation of the Federal Reserve System, a lot of catching up to address problems that had been festering for a long time and were almost but not quite out of control.
So you had a Republican Roosevelt, T.R.,
yes,
and then the Democrat, Woodrow Wilson, both sort of with the same agenda, progressive agenda.
There was a great deal of overlap and a great deal of rivalry. Theodore Roosevelt was a very young man when he made the mistake of not running again in 1908. Long story behind that. But for a lot of reasons, he was convinced that he needed to step down, two-term tradition and all that. So he recruited a successor, William Howard Taft, a mild-mannered, nice guy who had been an admirer of Theodore Roosevelt and was willing to do it. And only 4 years later, Roosevelt was convinced that Taft was blowing it. Everything was going down the tubes. Taft was, you know, well-intentioned fuddy-duddy who just, you know, couldn't put it over. So America in 1912 faced the spectacular drama of a former president who had handed the nomination of his party to his own hand-picked successor on a silver platter after only one term trying to take back what he'd given. Roosevelt challenged Taft in all the Republican primaries, but not all the states had primaries, and Roosevelt was not able to gain the Republican nomination, whereupon Roosevelt bolted the Republican Party, formed a new party called, guess what, the Progressive Party. This is his bull moose campaign. And the Republican Party was split wide open, so to be a Democrat in 1912. The convention, which was right here in Baltimore, went through, I believe, over 40 ballots. You know, everybody who was anybody wanted the nomination. And Wilson had only been in politics for 2 years. He was elected governor of New Jersey in 1910. Before that, he'd been an academician, president of Princeton, as you said. But his rise was meteoric. He had charisma. He was not one of the early favorites at the Democratic Convention, but when some of the more powerful early leaders knocked each other out, in effect, it was one of those conventions. Gradually, support for Wilson grew, and he got it. He was a very, very lucky man to have the Republican Party split open like that. Wilson was only elected with about 40% of the popular vote, but the result was almost inevitable.
You mentioned his nomination in Baltimore. The
yes.
Democratic National Convention held at the 5th Regiment Armory. Did you say 40 ballots?
Around 40.
Something like that.
It was something like that.
I've read H.L. Mencken's accounts of that convention. So Wilson comes out of that. He gets elected. The first couple of years in office are pretty good for him. He gets some legislation passed through.
He had a very ambitious legislative agenda in those first 2 years, and there was a lot to show for it. Now perhaps we'll talk about the world situation.
Let's talk about the world in 1914, because as I said, in 1914, war was looming in Europe.
War had been looming in Europe for a long time, and the latest power showdown among European great powers, the latest in many, many centuries of power showdowns among European powers, shaped up in the final decades of the 19th century when rival blocs began to shape up the Western powers or Allied powers of the First World War and the Central powers on the other side. Networks of mutual defense, mutual alliance, and one of the big provocations in play were the imperial aspirations of Germany, unified in the 1870s under Bismarck, now under the leadership of Kaiser Wilhelm II, seeking to make up for lost time in joining the topmost ranks of global powers. In particular, an Anglo-German naval rivalry. The Kaiser was determined to outbuild the Royal Navy. Was in play, and the situation was dangerous. The speed with which World War I broke out in 1914, triggered by the assassination of the heir to the Austro-Hungarian throne, shocked everybody. But there had been a sense of danger for some time.
A question. In 1912, when Woodrow Wilson was elected, was there talk about the possibility of war in Europe? Was that danger appreciated here?
There had been talk about the danger of war in Europe for the past decade. Theodore Roosevelt had offered his services as a mediator between the Germans and the French at the Algeciras Conference, imperial rivalries in Africa, for example. When Theodore Roosevelt, on return from his African safari, first thing he did after stepping down from the White House, more adventure out in the wild, quintessentially Rooseveltian thing to do. And on the way back, he went through the capitals of Europe, met the crowned heads of state, including Kaiser Wilhelm, and Andrew Carnegie begged Theodore Roosevelt to please, please talk peace with the Kaiser. This is in 1910. So there had been concerns about this, you know, danger for a long time.
In 1912, when Woodrow Wilson was nominated, the Democratic nominee for president, and then elected, had he been forced to or been asked to, or did he find it necessary to make a pledge of not intervening in any foreign war, in a European war? Was the danger that acute?
No. There was a general sense of concern, but the 1912 campaign in the United States was absolutely dominated by domestic issues, not least of all the intellectual rivalry between Wilson and Theodore Roosevelt, who had different prescriptions for progressive reform.
So 1914 comes. Woodrow Wilson is in the White House for a couple of years there. He's been focused, as you say, mostly on a domestic agenda. He's had some success with a cooperative Congress, because I believe the Congress is all
the Democrats. Won control of Congress in 1912.
Right. So when war breaks out, and it's August, the guns of August, you know, 1914, and as you said, it happened so quickly and rapidly, and people were shocked. What was the president's immediate reaction to that, the president of the United States?
Well, the president's immediate reaction was to be appalled, and a great many people in Europe and in the United States were appalled at the speed with which it broke out and got out of control, and before many months had passed, the appalling casualties. But in addition, two other things have to be considered. Woodrow Wilson's party, the Democratic Party, at the time was overwhelmingly averse to intervention in foreign wars. The Republican Party had a non-interventionist wing as well. The Republican Party was deeply split on this issue. The Republican Party was overwhelmingly averse to getting involved in a war. Number two, notwithstanding that, Woodrow Wilson saw fit to intervene in a foreign country, Mexico, when in the throes of an ongoing revolution, a military officer assassinated the country's legitimate president and took over. And Wilson was determined to help freedom-loving Mexicans oust this usurping dictator.
Did he send troops?
He certainly did in 1914 at Tampico in Veracruz. And what he did was to succeed in uniting all the other Mexican factions against these interfering gringos. It was not a good omen. Wilson could, depending on a lot of things, go either way.
Richard Striner is our guest on Midday, a historian from Washington College. His latest book is about Woodrow Wilson and World War I. That's what it's called. The subtitle, A Burden Too Great to Bear. We'll take a brief break here, Richard, and we'll come back and talk some more.
Okay.
Welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here, along with our guest, Washington College historian Richard Striner, as we are walking the hallways of the White House, occupied 100 years ago by Woodrow Wilson, the nation's 28th president, is the subject of Richard Striner's latest book, Woodrow Wilson and World War I, A Burden Too Great to Bear. Tell us about this man, Woodrow Wilson. I know he was the son of a Presbyterian minister. He was born in Virginia.
He was indeed. He was the son of a Presbyterian minister, a bookworm as a child and a young man, academically inclined, although he had been inclined at an early age to consider following in his father's footsteps and become a clergyman. I have to editorialize and say that the world might have been much better off if he had done that. But he entered the field of law, found himself bored by the day-to-day practice of law, but found himself interested in the applications of law to a career in statesmanship. He had been a great admirer of Sir William Gladstone, the High Victorian Prime Minister, and had dreamed at an early age of possibly becoming a great statesman. But he was introverted, a bit shy, had to get over that, and he did. He had latent charisma, and he found ways to cultivate that and become a fairly commanding presence, which he did in the classroom after he decided to get out of law, get a PhD in political science, and teach.
And PhD from Johns Hopkins.
Yes, he did. Got a teaching position in political science at Princeton and talked so impressively that he became the president of that university. But then he got into trouble at Princeton as president, political trouble, vis-a-vis campus politics, all kinds of trouble, trouble with other faculty, deans, alumni. A number of Wilson scholars have studied that interlude and seen in it baleful implications for what was to follow. A very strange character, Woodrow Wilson, very, very intelligent in many ways, capable of acting very intelligently, but at his worst, rash, impulsive, histrionic in the worst sense, and inclined to project religious visions into not only his own day-to-day life, but into the drama being played out in American and world politics with himself in the role of a latter-day prophet. This sounds like an exaggeration, sounds hard to believe, but I could quote you from Wilson in full cry by 1918 and 1919, and there is just no doubt about it. He believed. I mean, religious piety was very, very commonplace at that time, and of course still is. But Wilson's brand of Christian piety was fundamentally different in that it was in many ways millennial. He really did expect something along the lines of the prophecy of global peace foretold in Isaiah to transpire in his own lifetime, and he expected, at least by the end, to play a direct role as an oracle, prophet, heralding that arrival and in some ways helping it all to happen.
Now, wasn't that also evident, Richard Striner, in Woodrow Wilson after the outbreak of World War I?
Didn't
he believe he could become the great peacemaker here?
It came to him in an epiphany that it was his great role in history to help the world out of this nightmare, to do it through a magnificent gesture of his own that would bring the warring parties to the peace table.
One single grand gesture.
Well, one single campaign, all along the same lines, to be worked out, you know, step by step. And in the succeeding years between 1914 and early 1917, Wilson twisted and turned and writhed, you know, in a series of frantic efforts to somehow make this vision come true, and it didn't. He couldn't.
I got to step back a little bit here and point out a couple of strange things. Well, you just described one thing about Woodrow Wilson that sounds pretty strange, but also pretty strange to me is someone who's basically an academician, president of a university, emerging from that role to become governor of New Jersey, and you say actually develop some latent charisma,
yes,
good enough to campaign, shake some hands, get some votes.
Oh, he
right?
was a stirring orator. There's
he
no
was.
Question about
okay.
it.
Okay, because it isn't clear in his early life. So where did that come from? Did it come from the classroom? Did he hone that in the classroom?
It came from within. You know, any biography is a fascinating tale of actualizing potentialities.
Yeah.
And it's a complicated process, you know, wherein certain influences and experiences elicit, you know, from down below, certain tendencies, often very contradictory tendencies that could conceivably go in very different directions. But this is the way it played out for him. problem was, and this is one of my arguments in the book, the man at his worst became so histrionic that he disdained to engage in practical power orchestration or strategy. I'm not going to say that he was incapable of it, because at his best, and sometimes he was at his best as a leader, he could work very effectively and shrewdly, you know, to manipulate events and people in order to pull things off. But more and more in World War I, this ability left him. It's a terrible story, and there's another dimension to it as well that might as well be mentioned here as any other time. Wilson was diagnosed in 1906 with arteriosclerosis, and he was crippled by a devastating stroke on October 2, 1919. The underlying condition of hardening of the arteries had been progressing from 1906 to 1919. None of the medical methods available now to treat this condition existed then. There were a few things doctors tried, but, you know, not very efficacious. And about a generation ago or more, some medical specialists in cerebrovascular disease who are familiar, you know, with these kinds of conditions, how arteriosclerosis affects the brain and the mind, noticed in Wilson's behavior, especially in the few years preceding 1919, that it was almost a textbook case of what happens in conditions like this when they, you know, are untreated. By the 1970s, several physicians who had studied the historical record quite carefully concluded that Wilson, as early as 1917, was suffering from episodic dementia. And there is no doubt in my mind that this condition had a great deal to do with various forms of psychological and mental dysfunctionality in Wilson's thought patterns and in his behavior.
Was there anyone around at that time pointing this out, discussing it? Colonel Edward House, am I right?
Yes.
Colonel Edward, the Colonel.
Yes.
He was the right-hand man of Woodrow Wilson. Was he aware of any of this? Is there any record of that?
I've been through all of the Wilson papers. It took very little doing on my part. Arthur S. Link, a great historian, the foremost Wilson scholar of his generation, edited the Wilson papers into a 69-volume series from the 1960s through the 1980s. I've been through the whole thing, and I don't recall seeing anything in House's diary or correspondence that speaks to the issue. Wilson's first wife, Ellen Axon Wilson, who passed away about a month before World War I broke out, certainly did know about it and was fearful of what the future implications might be.
When you say it was untreated, that means White House doctors included did not treat him for this?
Well, there was very little that could be done at that time. Wilson's physician in his White House years was a naval officer and physician, Dr. Carey S. Grayson, who was assigned to Wilson, and the two of them became very, very close friends, and by the end, Grayson was vying with House and others, you know, within the Wilson entourage to be chief advisor on foreign policy matters. Grayson, so far as I understand, tended to be a generalist, and he was not particularly keen on consulting specialists, you know, right away. One of these people inclined to think that he himself could pretty much do it all, you know, to the extent necessary. And when Wilson was ill, Grayson would care for him. I haven't found anything in the record showing that Grayson was particularly alert to you know, cerebrovascular issues. After Wilson did have the stroke, it was diagnosed by a specialist. And then Wilson's second wife, Edith Bowling Galt Wilson, prevailed upon Grayson to keep that fact from the public and ascribe Wilson's illness to exhaustion.
We're speaking with Richard Schreiner about his book, the subject of his book, Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson in World War I is the title, A Burden Too Great to Bear. I'm going to step away from Woodrow Wilson for a minute and talk about the politics of the United States with regard to World War I and the outbreak of the war in the late summer of 1914 and then continuing into 1915 with submarine warfare. Wilson's party, the Democratic Party, is opposed to intervening in the European war. And the Republicans, where are they?
The Republican Party was quite divided. The Democrats were overwhelmingly non-interventionist for a lot of reasons. There was a strong anti-interventionist wing within the Republican Party as well, but it was in conflict with a very interventionist wing led by former President Theodore Roosevelt and others. Roosevelt, in his presidency, well, for years before he became president, Theodore Roosevelt wanted to see the United States join the world's great powers. As Assistant Secretary of the Navy under McKinley, Roosevelt had worked to build, you know, America's naval power. Panama Canal was not least of all a project to give the United States more efficacious two-ocean naval capabilities. Roosevelt absolutely wanted the United States to assert itself on the world scene, and others within the Republican Party did as well, but not all Republicans by a long shot.
Did they think that would be good for business? In other words, the munitions industry, building up our military?
There certainly were economic interests in play both ways. The business community was, in fact, divided on this. There, during the Spanish-American War, for example, Theodore Roosevelt was disgusted with a number of conservative Republican businessmen who viewed the war as a waste of money and so on. It's dangerous to, you know, overgeneralize about ideological trends within any particular sector of opinion. But Theodore Roosevelt, I mean, there were issues of expanding American markets and opening up overseas outlets for American exports. But to Theodore Roosevelt and others like him, it transcended such issues. Power was fundamental, but power was to be used for noble ends. Okay. And Theodore Roosevelt wanted the United States to have the power to do good in the world, good according to different standards,
okay.
Surely.
In the context of World War One, then, you have this conflict that's broken out in Europe. There's already lots of blood has been spilled in the summer and fall of 1914. We're into 1915 now, and we have submarine warfare. And Theodore Roosevelt who's saying to Wilson, you have got to arm up, you've got to build up your munitions, you have to have a strong military here in order to assert yourself and to say to these the Germans and the French and the British to end this conflict, that we're not going to stay, the U.S. can't stay neutral the whole time. You have to have this hammer ready to go.
Theodore Roosevelt and several others were saying that in the autumn of 1914. They were saying, some of them believed already, that the United States should intervene against Germany, the alleged German atrocities in Belgium. And a number of these atrocity stories did prove true. Convinced Theodore Roosevelt, Henry Cabot Lodge, and others that the United States really should, you know, get into the war against the Central Powers because Germany was behaving in a barbaric way and that German victory would imperil the United States later. And so forth. But there were people urging a military preparedness buildup who didn't go quite that far, but who believed that if the war did continue for a long time and get much worse, it probably would begin to affect America's vital interests and that America needed to have some force at its disposal in order to protect its legitimate interests. And Wilson, in the autumn of 1914, absolutely rejected such reasoning. Mostly because he was just entranced by this vision of being a peacemaker and how plausibly, he thought to himself and then asked others, how plausibly can we offer our services as a peacemaker if we ourselves are preparing for war? It's incongruous. We shouldn't do it. So
what do you buy? Excuse me. What do you buy in that argument?
Very little, because as early as the end of the first year of war, 1914, the casualties were so horrendous that in terms of power politics, in terms of ordinary human psychology, the prospect of getting both sides to the peace table was becoming increasingly remote. It might seem, and some people at the time, for some people it did seem, that the sheer horrendousness of the casualties would make itself felt soon enough everywhere as an imperative to just stop it. You know,
right.
it was a meaningless slaughter, and eventually
it wouldn't last very long because both sides would cave.
Would see that it was ridiculous and horrible, and everybody would just decide we've got to find some way to end this. But that's not the way it played out. The way it played out was that not only the leaders of both sides, but significant numbers of people within the general populations wanted to fight the war through to victory because the fortunes of war would go back and forth. And as the war on the battlefield would shift back and forth, first favoring one side and then another, certainly the people on the losing side were quite happy to consider the prospect of a ceasefire that would contain further losses. But those on the winning side naturally wanted to redeem all the death by winning. And that's the way it would continue to be all the way through until very, very close to the end.
But in 1914 and into 1915, the subject of your book, Richard Strainer, Woodrow Wilson, holds out this hope of acting as a mediator. I'm going to quote here from a speech that he gave in Indianapolis that you quote. This is a rhetorical question he asks. It's a very appealing passage. I'm going to read this. He says, Do you not think it likely that the world will sometime turn to America and say, you were right and we were wrong. You kept your heads when we lost ours. You tried to keep the scale from tipping, but we threw the whole weight of arms in one side of the scale. Now, in your self-possession, in your coolness, in your strength, may we not turn to you for counsel and assistance?
That's it. That sums up what Wilson was hoping would happen, and it didn't, because other things were happening too.
Richard Strainer, our guest here on Midday, will take another break. Richard Strainer's book, Woodrow Wilson and World War I, A Burden Too Great to Bear. A short break on Midday. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here, along with our guest, Richard Strainer, professor of history at Washington College. His latest book is Woodrow Wilson and World War I, A Burden Too Great to Bear. You're a Lincoln scholar.
Yes.
You spent a lot of time on President Lincoln and written a couple of books about him. And I wonder, you know, going into this project, examining Woodrow Wilson, who some historians say was a great president, other historians say was an awful president, you got the shadow of Lincoln in your, at least in your mind, looming over your examination of Woodrow Wilson. And I just wonder if you would comment about that, regarding that.
You're quite right.
Yeah.
The shadow of Lincoln was looming over Wilson's mind, too, because Wilson, before very long, began to see himself as a Lincoln-esque figure. I'm sorry to have to say I don't think so. One of the things that interested me from the outset with Lincoln was his sheer brilliance as a power orchestrator, a Machiavellian strategist, an idealist who could summon immense power and wield it in a very cunning way to bring about the results that he wished to achieve. And by the standards of Lincoln, Woodrow Wilson, to me, was exactly the reverse. At his worst, he was a non-strategist. You know, he just believed that beautiful ideals, beautiful words, and God's providence would make it all happen. So why, you know, should there be any grubby power-mongering? That was part of the bad old days that we're going to leave behind us. At his worst, he was a non-strategist. At his next worst, when he did try to engage in strategy, he was an incompetent strategist. He let one opportunity for power leverage go. He wasn't always at his worst, as I said before, which makes it tricky propositioning, doing justice to this man, because when he was at his best, and he was sometimes, he could be quite good. But more and more over the course of World War I, his better qualities fell by the wayside.
Didn't he feel as president that his duty was to keep the United States out of World War I? Isn't that what people wanted? I don't know if there was polling done in those days, but it certainly seemed what his,
wanted,
right?
There was overwhelming opposition to war, and especially within the Democratic Party. So there's no question that Wilson did believe he had to do everything possible to keep the United States out of war. However, by 1915, the United States was getting deeply involved in the war because of this overseas arms trade. Both sides, once the war became total, realized that they were going to reach the end of their resources, industrial and agricultural, quickly, and that they needed to place orders with the United States for not only weapons and munitions, but food. Trouble was, only one of the two sides could do business with the United States, because the German high seas fleet was bottled up in the North Sea. The Royal Navy, however, controlled, the Atlantic sea lanes.
Mm-hmm.
But then the Germans were able to get U-boats out into the Atlantic sea lanes. Anyway, it was a lopsided trade in armaments that the United States was engaged in via the British, with the British and their allies, the French, and by 1915, the Italians, who had switched sides.
So already we were involved.
We weren't involved.
Officially involved. Our government wasn't involved. We hadn't declared war. But...
And there were calls in Congress for Congress to step in and prohibit the overseas sale of armaments, something comparable to what Congress did in 1935, in the Isolationist Neutrality Act. Congress could have done it under broad construction of the Constitution, power to regulate interstate commerce. Wilson shot it down. Wilson took an extremely legalistic position in 1915 on a lot of these oceanic issues that were pulling the United States further into the vortex of war. In order to avoid German U-boats, the British began shipping weapons and munitions in the cargo hold of passenger liners like the Lusitania, and American passengers were traveling on such ships. And there were calls in Congress to warn Americans not to travel as civilian passengers on ocean liners that might be carrying weapons of war. And the Germans put ads in American newspapers saying Americans don't travel on British ships. And there were calls in Congress to have the administration take action and tell American citizens they were doing that at their own risk and at their own responsibility. Wilson absolutely refused to do that. And the reason why, and this was not an effective way to keep the United States out of harm's way, Wilson's first Secretary of State, William Jennings Bryan, kept telling Wilson, you really need to do more to keep our nation and its foreign policy from being held hostage by the foolhardiness of people who go sailing, into the middle of this terrible peril. Wilson absolutely refused to do it. And the reason why he refused to do it sounds crazy, but he made it pretty clear. In order for him to be able to mediate the war, the United States had to be unimpeachably neutral, impeccably neutral, pure and immaculate in its neutrality. And you've got to prove that to the world by vigorously upholding every right under international law that neutral nations and their citizens have. So that if under international law it's legal to sell arms, to a nation of war, you have to do it. If it's legal under international law for the citizens of a neutral nation to travel unmolested, on any ship, they have to do it. And that's why Wilson refused to take a number of prudent steps, that could have decreased the peril.
He also wanted to wear this cape of neutrality by not building up the military, asking for a military buildup.
Right? Exactly. Yeah. But everything flowed from this dream of himself, being the mediator. Everything flowed from that. In order to make that happen,
did he ever get this opportunity? Was there ever a summit where this Woodrow Wilson? I don't remember seeing a picture of Woodrow Wilson with the Kaiser and the King of England. I mean,
he tried. And his close friend and advisor, Colonel Edward House, kept telling Wilson, give me a chance. I think I can set this up. And so House made several trips to Europe. Ambassador, not an official ambassador, in no way, responsible to foreign service channels within the State Department, just operating without instructions, too, mm-hmm. directly, as the agent of the president, trying to put together some way to force the nations to the peace table. And in late 1915 and early 1916, House concocted this scheme with the British foreign minister, Lord Edward Grey, to the effect that Wilson would demand that both sides state their war aims and declare their willingness to submit to mediation. And whichever side refused to do this first would earn the enmity of the United States, and the United States would then throw its full support to the side that accepted.
Okay.
And
what was wrong with that idea?
Well, it just wasn't going to happen because events kept overtaking it.
Right. What finally got the United States into World War One, Richard Steiner? 1917?
German resumption of unrestricted submarine warfare. Germany decided from time to time to suspend submarine operations against neutral vessels. Mostly, and there was a big debate within the German high command about this, and the Kaiser had to mediate it sometimes, but the issue always was using the submarine weapon for maximum short-term advantage as opposed to holding it back for use later on, you know, when the situation would be maximally advantageous. And when the Germans decided to just shoot the works in 1917, knowing that it would bring the United States in, the idea was the Germans shift all of our might to the Eastern Front, knock the Russians out, win totally on the Eastern Front, then transfer all of our resources to the Western Front for the knockout blow in France, and do it so quickly that it'll happen before the United States can get in, because the United States is so far behind the curve in military preparedness. That was why. And the Germans came, you know, fairly close to doing it in 1917.
When Woodrow Wilson went before Congress and asked for a declaration of war, boy, that was a very different president from the one just a couple years earlier.
It was a very different president from the one just a year earlier. He was really showing the stress. He told House, you know, after it became clear that he was not going to be able to get the both sides to the peace table, that the United States would have to go in. He told House he was completely disoriented. He said, "It's like the world has started revolving in the opposite direction. I'm trying to get my bearings." He had no plans, you see.
Yeah, no strategy.
He had finally decided to support preparedness legislation. And he made a very effective speaking tour in early 1916 and worked pretty effectively in Congress in 1916 to get the legislation through. But by the time the legislation was passed and he signed it in the fall of 1916, less than half a year remained before the United States, you know, would have to go to war.
And he was reelected in 1916.
He kept us out of war.
He kept us out of war. That was the theme of that.
One of the really tragicomic aspects of 1916 is that briefly, by the end of the year, it looked like the United States might have to get into the war as an ally of Germany against the British, because U.S.-British relations suddenly deteriorated in 1916 for all kinds of reasons, and the Germans were behaving themselves, and Wilson had no, you know, plans for that eventuality either.
Richard Steiner, as I mentioned briefly earlier, and as you well know, Woodrow Wilson, the name Woodrow Wilson appears on various lists of historians, lists of great presidents, mediocre presidents. He seems to be at one extreme or the other, actually, great president or deeply flawed president. And you went into this project of this book, Woodrow Wilson and World War One, with a pretty open mind. This is a judicious analysis of the history of that period and of that president?
I went into the project with an open mind to this extent. I had taught this period in American history for a long time, and I was familiar enough with the course of events and the key decisions Wilson had made to have come to a pretty dim conclusion already.
You already had a dim view going in.
I certainly did, especially compared to Lincoln's achievements as a strategist, but I was open-minded.
I was giving you more credit than you deserve, actually.
Well, I got to be honest.
I'm kidding you.
I have to be honest. I did have, let us say, a thesis. I had a hypothesis that I wanted to test, because this was the impression I had. But I wanted to go through all the records and see, you know, if the most careful scrutiny of the documents would bear it out. And I did find several things that surprised me in a positive way. I had no idea that Wilson's preparedness campaign was so good. I mean, he was really at his best on preparedness in 1916. I was not prepared to see him as good in action as he was then, and I say so in the book. But with that and a few other exceptions aside, When I really got into it, I found that I had no idea how right I was, you know, about the bad part. And it's not a happy story to have to recount. I was not out to do a hatchet job on Wilson so much as to show the terrible things that can result if leaders do not have sufficient competence in strategy and power orchestration so as to be able to deliver good results. If you can't do that, you may set your own cause back by giving a good cause a bad name. Let me give you another example. Wilson correctly foresaw the danger of vindictive peace, very much to his credit. In January of 1917, just a few months before the U.S. entered the war, Wilson gave a speech to the Senate calling for peace without victory. And Theodore Roosevelt ridiculed it and so on and so forth. I think Wilson was quite right. But what did he do, you know, to try to use such power as the United States had to bring the British and the French into line? He threw away one chance after another. He did not have the leverage he would have had if he'd started earlier on preparedness, because in 1917, the British and the French really needed American troops. And because Wilson was so far behind the curve on that, he couldn't deliver. But another thing they need...
Excuse me. On vindictive peace, though, what you're getting to is World War II, really, aren't you?
Well, what I'm getting to is the harsh Treaty of Versailles.
Yeah. And what some people say led eventually to the Second World War.
I'm one of those people, though that's a matter of historical controversy, too. But I'm convinced that the Treaty of Versailles was myopic and harsh, just as John Maynard Keynes said in 1919 in his book, The Economic Consequences of the Peace. Wilson foresaw it, and that's to his credit, so far as I'm concerned. But what is not to his credit is his failure to summon and use power in order to sway the British and the French. No, beautiful words, that'll do it. You know, no, it didn't do it. And what kind of power did he have early in 1917? Financial power. The British and the French had for several years been absolutely dependent on American supplies, and when they ran out of funds, they had to bankroll their purchases with American loans. In April 1917, they would absolutely have been out of the collateral that they needed for more loans, and Wilson could have used that to pressure them. He never even thought of it.
The subtitle of your book, Woodrow Wilson and World War I, is A Burden Too Great to Bear. Does that come from a quote, or is that your construct?
Oh, it's a subtitle that my editor and I talked over and decided to use.
Well, tell us about it.
Well, it speaks to the issue of interpretive intent, fair-mindedness. This is certainly a scathing assessment of Woodrow Wilson as a war leader, but I did try my best to be fair and accurate. And it seemed to me that a title and subtitle like this were pretty much right for a book with a message like this. There have been hatchet jobs, you know, done on Woodrow Wilson by people who simply didn't like the guy or people who had a different ideological agenda that they were pushing. And some of these hatchet jobs failed because they were, you know, simple-minded or overgeneralized. No, I wanted to write a critique that would be as sophisticated and complex and accurate as I could make it, but without pulling punches, you know, when it seemed time to come to conclusions. So that's why we chose this title and subtitle.
Well, thank you, Richard Steiner, for being with us today on Midday and talking about this very interesting period in history. I call Woodrow Wilson, after reading your book, A Tragedy Within a Tragedy.
Yes.
Woodrow Wilson and World War I is the title, subtitle, A Burden Too Great to Bear. It's Roman in Littlefield is the publisher of Richard Steiner's book. Richard Steiner has been our guest here on Midday. He's a professor of history at Washington College. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Dan.
And thank you, everyone, for tuning in. That's our Midday for today. Have a great afternoon. Dan Rodericks here. I'll see you again soon.
Midday's senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer and director is Jonathan Ahrens. The associate producer, Michael Himowitz. Our interns are Brian Gilbert, Tyler Downey, and Anna Muckerman. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming available at WYPR.org. Dan Rodrick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.